Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Bonna Pfeiffer.
And you are listening to Fiber Talk, the twice weekly podcast for the needlework artist. And our artist this week, Claudia Dutcher Kistler. Hi, Claudia.
Hello.
Oh, we're going to have some fun today. We met Claudia at Sassy Jack's for the Bristol Sampler weekend, and now we get to talk to her about what she's done and how she does it. So that's going to be fun. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
And speaking of Sassy Jack's, this podcast is sponsored by Sassy Jack's. And here's a word from Kim.
This edition of Fiber Talk is proudly sponsored by Sassy Jack's Stitchery. Sassy Jack's is a vibrant young needlework shop located on the picturesque main street of Weaverville, North Carolina, happily situated between Five Little Monkeys Quilt Shop and nationally recognized Well-Bred Bakery. We are nestled in a valley of the beautiful Blue Ridge Mountains of western North Carolina, just minutes north of Asheville and a short 20-minute drive from the Biltmore Estate, one of America's national treasures. Sassy Jack's Stitchery is proud to be a brick-and-mortar needlework shop, featuring cross-stitch, counted needlepoint, embroidery, and punch needle. We host a wonderful collection of fine antique needlework samplers on display, many of which have chartered patterns available for purchase. We frequently rotate our collection, so every visit is likely to yield a new treasure for you to enjoy. We are moving into our fall and winter season of stitching at Sassy Jack's, and we invite you to join us in one of the many opportunities we've created for you to stitch along and learn. We have a return of our tree decorating event, wherein everyone who sends us a newly stitched ornament for our tree by December 24th will receive a coupon for 15% off any single purchase during January and February. This year will also mark our third year doing our special Valentine's Day small exchange. We've opened our designer selection to include Summerhouse Stitchworks and Jeanette Douglas Designs, in addition to Plum Street Samplers. You may stitch any small design from any of these designers using a pattern and supplies from your stash or purchasing something new from us at Sassy Jack's. Finish it into a needlework small and send it to us before January 25th. We will exchange it from another in the group and send you a beautiful gift from your stitching sister just in time for Valentine's Day. Check out our website or upcoming newsletters for more details and finishing tips for these fun winter traditions at Sassy Jack's. We hope you find a way to visit us soon. If you can't make it to us, we hope you visit us online at Facebook, Instagram, SassyJackStitchery.com, and our new FlossTube channel, Yonder Ways. We love it when you stop by and say hi, whether it's in person or online. We truly appreciate you, and we really appreciate all we hear and learn from Fiber Talk. We are super proud to be a sponsor of this wonderful resource for stitching goodness. Thank you, Fiber Talk, for giving us some stabby pokey talk twice a week. Kim and team at Sassy Jack Stitchery.
Hey, thanks, Kim, and thanks for sponsoring the Fiber Talk podcast. And please, please support our sponsors. Fiber Talk made me buy it. Let people know that you heard it on Fiber Talk. And yeah, as Vonna has said more than once, if you need something, call Kim.
That's right.
Call her. Just call her.
Yep.
She'll have it. Okay, so we got to learn about Bristol Samplers, and we'll talk about those in a little bit. But one of the things in going through all of your information, Claudia, mm-hmm. is I was really surprised that you do so much with perforated paper.
I love paper. I've collected for 25, 30 years.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah, I have a big, big collection of perforated paper.
Oh, you do?
Big.
Oh.
Yeah, big.
Because, see, the first time I thought it was just a play thing. And then when I was at Vicki LaPiccolo yeah. Jennett's home and saw yep. an old, old sampler that a boy had done on paper.
Yep. Yep.
That changed my whole perspective. So this stuff has been around forever, as I've learned.
Yeah, about 1840 to about 1910 was like the first group. And then it came back again in about, I think, about 1970. So.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Now, do the old ones, are there very many of the old ones around? Do you know?
I think Vicki and I own most of them. Actually, I know a friend that owns the other third. So we've like divided them all up for the most part. Seriously, I'm.
Yeah, I have no doubt, because I got to believe that that paper just doesn't hold up.
It's pretty good unless you get it wet. Yeah. And the original papers were a little thicker. The hole count was higher, and the paper had more rag content in it. So the really early ones feel almost like a fabric, although they're stiffer. Mm. And then it just sort of changed as it went along, depending on how they processed it.
Does the the thread count, the whole count.
Whole count, yeah.
What is that? Was it finer back in the yeah. day?
Yeah, it started at about 24 to 26 holes per inch. And then it went, they got less per inch. And the most familiar thing for the paper is the mottos, like the home sweet home, God bless our home. Those were about 14 to 16 holes per inch. And those were printed. So my guess is they wanted something with a little bit more space on the paper so that you could print on it. But the original ones were smaller. And I know that Vicky is trying to reproduce a smaller count paper. So she's working on that.
Yeah, that's what we've understood, is that she's trying, and it sounds like it's quite a bit of a chore to get somebody to produce it and produce the quality.
It's sort of like the pyramids. You would think they couldn't build it with what they had then, but we can't build it now with what we got either. So how did they do it? You know, it's sort of like that. I mean,
we can't take a piece of cardboard and punch holes in it.
Nope. it's a cost effective thing. It's fine. There's a whole bunch of stuff. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, if she can get that going, then that'll just turn you guys loose then, right?
No, that'll make her happy. I don't mind actually working on the 14 count paper. I mean, it would be fun to have something smaller because then it's more authentic. But, you know, I sort of try and work with what I've got. And, I, you know, what we've got to work with is 14 holes per inch, then we'll do that. So it's okay.
Yeah. Well, I just think it's an interesting aspect. And then you had us at Sassy Jack's doing a little work on the paper.
And I took you to camp.
Yes. Yeah. But it was fun because it's a very different ground cloth.
Yeah. I try and put paper in everything I teach, whether the shop owner or whoever wants it or not. That's sort of part of what I do because I am a paper nut, paper collector. And so I try and do that. And it's a fun way. You can make things with paper. Like you can make those little pieces that you can cut into shapes and you don't have to frame it. And it's stiff. It's fun. It's fun.
Yeah.
That's another whole talk, probably, is for
this paper, yeah. Well, it was the last thing I expected to see was an antique sampler done on paper.
Yeah. They're rare. The samplers are always one of a kind. They're rarer. The mottos are the things you see the most. Bookmarks are probably the second thing you see the most. And anytime you see a sampler on paper, there's less of them, and they are rarer.
Mm-hmm.
And by a boy is even rarer still.
Yeah, that's the one. I really hope Vicky someday will reproduce that because
yeah.
By a boy on paper, that's a combination.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when you were growing up, it was fun reading about your history of family with a hardware store.
Yeah, that's a fun place.
Yeah, that was.
It was a little before me, but it was still fun. So.
Yeah. How many generations owned hardware store?
I would have been Dutcher the fourth. So three generations owned the hardware store of men. And three of them.
And then you wrecked it.
Yeah, I wrecked it. I came along and they said, oh, we're not doing this anymore. So, yeah.
would you have taken it over if you could have?
I don't know. It's possible. You know, you do what you know. And if you'd grown up in a business, maybe. Now, given that my son grew up when I owned a needlework store, and he has no desire to ever work retail again. So he's, so it just depends.
Yeah. Well, see, I just had visions of you spending afternoons and evenings in the store, just to be with family. And
that was a little, they sold it when I was probably about 12. So, yeah. So it didn't last that long, but it was a fun building. And by the time I came along, it was sort of, you know, it was sort of like a haunted house. It had all sorts of, you know, you see the chainsaw movies with stuff hanging from the ceiling. That was sort of like the back room because they had all, you know, they had all the equipment. They had all the farm equipment. They had all the, you know, it was fun, actually.
So it was one of those hardware stores where if you need a part and you can't find it anywhere, you go there and they'll have it.
Yeah,
okay.
You betcha. Because they started it. The family started it. When did they start it? In 1870s, I think.
Oh, my.
So it went from about 1870 to about 1970. So, you know, it'd been around for a bit.
Holy smokes.
And probably they had a few pieces that were still there from 1870 in that building.
Yeah, those kinds of hardware stores don't exist anymore.
No.
Yeah. Especially with farm equipment. Yeah.
A needlework store is, I always called it a hardware store for stitchers.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, they have all the fun parts and the fun things to play with. And
yeah.
The fun things you need and the fun things you can find out a need to have them, you know.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Those kind of needlework stores, skein of thread that's been out of manufacture for years. I have 4 skeins. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. I've had them for years.
Fun find. Yep.
I'm glad to sell them too.
Yeah.
And so then, and then you started out with a psychology degree.
I have
lofty plans to help mankind.
Yeah, I was going to work with disabled children and adults. You can transfer that however you want. We're still sort of doing that in a way. But no, I have a. You probably don't want to put that on the air. You can if you want.
Too late. Too late.
I have a psychology degree in physiological psych, which basically said every thing has a physical cause. Because I'd read too many books that said, well, this is all theory. And I thought, pfft. So I went and did the biology and physiology part.
Oh. Yeah.
And then, you know, life changes. And, you know, I was able to open a needlework store. I was a needlework store owner for 15 years. And then I had a studio that I just sold me for 3 years. And then I took it to my house and... You know, I've been a designer for 20 years doing different things and never expected to end up being the reference for Bristol Samplers. But that was, you know, I love that. I mean, that was awesome.
Yeah. So. Well, the one thing that stuck out of me in those early years is doing work for Sunset Designs. Cause I remember, I remember those. Yeah.
Oh, I have to tell you a story about that. So I actually worked in the needlepoint section of Sunset Designs. And the first thing they gave me to cross stitch, I sort of knew how to cross stitch, but they gave me to cross stitch and they said, okay, this is how you do your cross stitch and all your stitches on the back of the piece have to go straight up and down. That was my whole introduction from them about how to do a cross stitch model.
Whoa.
And they don't all go straight up and down, which all of you that do cross stitch are now shaking your head going, So anyway, it was interesting. It was fun. I mean, it was creative. It was fun. You could work on your own time, sort of. It was good.
Yeah. So you just stitched models for them or?
I beta tested patterns and did model stitching for the, what they used to call 4-color models, which was the front of the front of the kit, basically.
Right.
So we were the ones that we took the original designs and we tested it to make sure there wasn't, there were things we could change or there was mistakes or whatever. Yeah, it was fun.
So do I recall correctly that it was Sunset and Dimension were the two big
kit. In those days.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sunset started in somebody's garage in the Bay Area in California. So.
Okay.
Yeah. And Dimensions, I think, is more, I don't know where they are. I think they're more back east. So.
Yeah. I always had that impression, too, that one was out west and the other was somewhere here in the east.
Yeah.
They did.
They both did good. I mean, the stuff they presented was good. I mean, it was good quality for that day.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And you were, they got to be up straight up and down. Oh, man.
Yeah, I know. That's all they said. You have to cross across. I mean, they had you going across in rows, basically.
Yeah.
And your back had to be straight up and down. Well, when you were doing like one little stitch and you were trying to get, it was interesting. Learned a lot.
That's a lot of work. That's a lot of work for a model that's going to be a picture.
You know, yeah, your front and your back for when you're doing model stitching like that had to be. They didn't have to be a mirror of it, but they had to be very clean. And the whole thing had to be, it's amazingly, you know, there was a lot of work into making sure it was presentable.
Well, yeah, I guess.
Yeah. I'm glad I'm not doing that today, actually. So
yeah. Okay. I remember we had a Leanne's, I think it was Leanne's.
Yeah. That was like a fabric store or something,
right.
I think. Was it a fabric store? Yeah.
Yeah, and they had all kinds of needlepoint and cross stitch, and I remember going up and down the aisles, Dimensions and Sunset, and you know which of these am I going to buy? And yeah,
they were good. Yep.
Yep.
I think I still have some in my garage. If you're interested, we can.
I'm good, Claudia. Thank you. That's all right.
Okay, thanks.
I think I'm okay. Yeah, I'll be fine. Well, I struggled with those. I always struggle with kits because the question I have is, will there be enough thread that if I make a mistake, you know, and that always made me nervous about those kits is I'm going to come up short of the main color. And
Yeah.
Straight up and down. I don't know. That's
See, just think about that. Look at the back of your cross stitch piece some time ago. Is everything straight up and down on the back? And you're going to go, I don't think so.
No. Yeah, you really got me spinning on that one. That's, no thanks. No thanks at all.
I still remember it. So it was a long time ago, too. That one stuck with me.
Yeah. Yep. And then I'm always interested in where you learn. So you learned mainly, it sounded like, most of your creative things from your grandmother then.
I learned a lot from my grandmother. I've always been I always was creative as a kid. So I was always trying things. And I'll tell you my first counted cross stitch piece that I bought. I bought a kit for $3, and of course it was in the sale bin, and it was a cat. And I took it home, and I took it out, and there was the pattern, and there was this blank piece of 18 count Aida. And I went, this is interesting. There's nothing printed on this. And so I did that kit, and then that was my first big count across stitch kit. I still have it. It's still hanging up. And in those days, I paid $3 for the kit, and I paid $30-something to have it framed. Now, I know that's nothing today, but proportionally, you know, and I still have that. So that was my first big count across stitch thing that I did.
When did you start the store?
1991.
Obviously, the retail part is in your genes. You can't get that out. But
I always wanted to be a store owner. There were store owners on both sides of my family. So, you know, I sort of had to give it a go. So. Yeah.
So did you start the classic thing, start in the basement or the home and then move to a store? Or were you able to?
No, I just went the whole hog. I rented a building. I left a job. My husband now, who wasn't my husband then, had gone away for a couple months. He used to go fishing in Alaska for, you know, by the time he came home, I had left my job. I had put in a lease on the building and I was going to open a shop. And he looked at me like I was absolutely nuts.
he went fishing. You quit your job and opened up a retail business?
Yeah, pretty much.
While he's fishing. Oh, man.
Yeah, pretty much. But see, I wasn't married to him, so I wasn't responsible. So the money wasn't connected, so it was okay.
Act quick before we get married.
Yeah, do it now. Well, you know, it's something you always wanted to do. I had the opportunity to do it. I knew I could survive for I had money planned. I had planned it, so I knew that if it didn't work, that I had something to live on and I could do it for this long. And I thought, you know, if I don't do it now, I was in my mid-30s, I guess. And if I didn't do it then, I probably wouldn't get the opportunity. So let's go do it, you know? Yeah. It's fun.
Yeah, and so that apparently some success with that.
Yeah, it was good. I thought it was a good shop. I think my customers liked it.
Yeah. Primarily cross-stitch, or what was your...
Cross-stitch and needlepoint to start out. We had a needlepoint store that opened in the next town, so I dropped the needlepoint, and then toward the end of it, I put in yarn, so I did crochet and knitting. I'm a crocheter, I'm a basic knitter, and I hired an excellent person to be my knitting person, so yeah.
Yeah, you almost have to have that, don't you?
Yeah. And cross-stitch was the basic. I mean, we had a really good selection. We had a really good fabric selection and not as many threads as some people, but our fabric selection was good. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
I thought, anyway. Well, so.
If it worked, it worked. So you just at some point get tired of it and want to just do designing. And so.
I started doing designing because I needed something creative for me. Owning a store is fun, but if you're creative, it's not. You need something more. So I decided I needed something also that what made Dutch Treat Needlecrafts different than someplace else. And so that's when I started doing the table toppers because I like them. And people kept saying, well, I want to stitch something. I love this fabric, but I don't want to stitch an afghan. So I started with that. People thought I was nuts doing that too. And that was very successful, actually. I still have people complaining that I'm not doing new designs. But, then it sort of took off from there. Then I collected paper. I wanted to do the motto designs. So I started doing those. After I you know, after I wasn't doing retail, just doing home retail from home, mail order retail, mm-hmm. then I sort of fell into the Bristol vortex because I had a little bit more time. So,
Tell me about Ancloth. I don't know a thing about that.
Ancloth is an Afghan fabric from Swaggart that's been around since dirt. It's been around a long time. And it comes in cotton, a cotton blend, and it's a polyacrylic. And I like the polyacrylic because you can wash it. You can, you can actually use it. You don't have to be careful with it. And it's a patterned fabric. So it's got a 5-inch woven. It's got a border woven every 5 inches. So you have a border in the fabric with a 5-inch stitching area. And it's been around. Leisure Arts carried it for a long time. You bought it through Leisure Arts. I started buying it from Swaggart directly when I was buying like 5 bolts at a time of it. So, I said, we need to make a deal here. I need to buy more directly. Been around for a long time.
So that now I understand the designs then.
Yeah.
Because of those borders. So you had, that's kind of fun.
Yeah, it's all the same format. I mean, because you have a nine square piece that you're designing for.
Yeah.
But all the designs are different. It's like stitching on, I'm going to use the Aida words. It's like stitching on Aida, but you're using the same ground fabric, but your designs are different. You know, you've seen some designers that you can tell, this is by so-and-so because they all look the same.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the tabletoppers do not all look the same, so...
No. Okay. Now I understand. Cause I'd never heard of Ancloth, I thought you have these designs that are these grids.
Yeah.
But then each one is very unique. Oh man. Is the weave like Aida or is it more of a even weave linen thing?
No, it's an even weave linen. Lemon? Yeah, it's an even weave linen. It's 18 threads per inch. You stitch over 2 threads, so you have 9 stitches per inch, and that sounds like it's really big, but if you actually look at them, they don't look clunky. I mean, they just don't look clunky. And I use size 5 pearl cotton instead of using. I did the first one with 4 strands of floss, and I thought this is nuts. I'm never going to do this. So yeah. I use size 5 pearl cotton and the Karen watercolors, 1 ply of that. That's how I got involved with the Karen people. And it's great. I mean, it's easy. It's washable. You can spill stuff on it. You can put spray and wash on it, throw it in the washing machine and wash it. Kid you not.
Oh, I believe you. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and then to be able to use just pearl cotton and just go. Yeah.
Yeah. Just one. It's like using 1 strand of silk or 1 strand of anything is always better than working with plies of stuff.
Right. Now this is the thing that always bugs me about these things is the backside, finishing them off so that you can wash them and use them and they don't threads don't come out.
You run your tails in longer.
Okay.
You take a longer run than you would for you use a longer piece to start with, so you have less stuff you have to cut and paste. And then when you're done, you just run your tails in like you would behind your regular cross stitch piece, but you run it a little longer.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because that's the part that always makes me nervous is, after 3 washings, then I got to restitch half of it.
Yeah, no. if you did that, you just didn't anchor it securely enough. So, yeah.
Okay. Just always curious. And so you must have been one of the early bigger users of Karen threads then.
They love me. I think they still like me, actually. So,
yeah. you've been degraded from love to like. Okay.
I think they still. I haven't ordered a lot lately, but no, they're just very sweet. I've actually, I've worked in the Karen booth at wholesale shows for them on the West Coast. I've helped them with, I've been one of their booth people, and I just love them. Their thread is wonderful. Their colors are great. I adore them. I think they're wonderful.
Yeah. I just think of,
I really do.
Yeah. Whenever they come up, I always think of how many designs have been based off of any one of their variegated multicolored base threads. And then people will go off of that. Those have formed the base of so many things.
They're good.
Yeah. Yep. And a pleasure. It, well, and they have such a range too. I mean, all the way to silks mm-hmm. and everything else. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so, they care. They care about what they do. They care about quality. They care about what they put out. And not that other companies don't, but I know behind the scenes how much these ladies do. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I was talking just this past Wednesday with Debbie Raleigh about her mm-hmm. designs and selecting threads. And, you know, she was talking about how her threads selection a lot of times is based on how old the company is, because then she knows that they'll still be in business a couple, 3 years from now, and she won't have a design sitting there with people yeah. immediately having to substitute threads and
yeah.
You know, how powerful yeah. that is.
Well, you know, cross stitchers and needle pointers too want what they see. They right. want what the designer did. And unless you have a shop owner that can really handhold and tell them it's okay, you can do this, if they can't get a thread or they can't get something, that can be very frustrating.
Right.
So,
yeah, we all like to talk about changing colors and making it your own, but the vast majority, they see on the cover and that's what they want. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That keeps designers in business. Thank you very much. we appreciate that. We appreciate that.
So the table toppers and your motto designs on perforated paper or cross stitch, whatever you want to do. So you're not mm-hmm. designing more of those, but you're still selling them.
I'm not doing any more table toppers. I haven't released any motto designs for a bit. I think I have 3 or 4 more charted. They're just sort of sitting here. So we'll see.
Okay.
If the demand goes up, I might. So I get all excited about it and it goes out and everybody goes, oh, good. And it's like, okay, well, I'll go do something else then.
So when does the Bristol sampler thing enter the picture?
When does that
little rabbit hole show up?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you the same story I told at the class that I tell everybody. You know, somebody's going to tell it back to me one of these days. I was getting ready to do a retail show. I was all packed up. And I was surfing on the internet and I saw a sampler on Amy Finkel's website that had exactly the same motifs and the ship that was on a sampler that I owned. And she wanted $14,000 for it. And I had no idea what that was because I had bought my sampler for a whole lot less money than that. But I bought it because I liked it and I just liked the motifs and I liked the things that were on it. And so I wanted to find out what I owned because, you know, that's actually a good idea.
Yep.
I have a cat in my lap. So if we get disconnected, you can blame the cat here.
Okay.
So we went to find out, you know, then I came back from the show and started researching what I had. And of course, what I had was a multicolor Bristol sampler. And when I started this in, I think it was probably about 2000 or a little earlier. If you had asked people what a Bristol sampler was, they would have said they're always done in red and they're always this or that. Well, we found out, you know, since then that that's not actually the case. So
that multicolor, then you just bought that because you liked it and had no idea that you had.
No, I had no idea. And it had a no cross, no crown, like a vertical no, and then a cross, shape of a cross, and then the word letters in O, and then a crown. And that's very typical on perforated paper bookmarks. That was a very typical, you know, type of motif that they did on bookmarks. So I'm putting the cat down now. Let's see if he disconnects me. There we go. So I bought it because I like that, and I like the ship, and I like the colors, and yeah, I had no idea, none, zip.
Have you always been an antique collector, or?
Yes.
Okay. Okay.
I'm a collector.
Oh, okay.
And I've always liked samplers. In my shop, I probably couldn't sell a sampler pattern to pay my rent. So my customer base was Told the Garden, Lavender and Lace, all those, which are excellent, excellent designs. And I would say, look at this sampler, look at these letters, isn't this cool? And they would look at me like, okay, fine, let's go look at the Lizzie Cakes, which is fine, which is okay. So, you know, I've always loved sampler stuff. But people don't know how much what I do with it, because it's normally not part of what I do for a public persona. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Vanna aside, it seems to me there's been just a huge surge of interest in samplers in the past X years.
Yeah, and I think Jean from Attic Needlework is one of those people that's helped that. There's been other shops. Kim from Sassy Jacks has also, fueled the fire of this. So, yeah, it's fun. I like it.
Yeah, well,
I know, too.
Yeah, really, Vanna?
Good for me and Vanna. We're good.
Would you like to get that on the record, Vanna?
Yes.
Well, I knew nothing about them other than I had purchased a couple of the Sampler Quarterly?
Yeah, they did a great job.
That magazine. I bought a couple of those and read them, but I just didn't appreciate what they were talking about. It just didn't sink in. And then as I became more aware of them, it's really an addicting area just because of the history, and there's so mm-hmm. many different ones available.
The more you see, the more you learn. And the more you learn, if it lights you up, then the more you want to see. You know, mm-hmm. it's like a circle that keeps going. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. I was a longtime subscriber to the Sampler and Antique mm-hmm. Needlework Quarterly, but I didn't have a great appreciation for it until, I did. I mean, that magazine was fabulous.
Yes.
And I was not exposed to it because I was just some little island in the middle of Indiana that crossed it. And I really didn't know anybody else. And I think that the internet has opened up so many avenues, and you can share and learn and find out stuff. And mm-hmm. so when I started blogging, 14, 15 years ago, that opened up a whole new world to me. And I think that there's always been like this staunch set of people that, like Jean and mm-hmm. and others that have always done samplers. And I always admired them, but I didn't understand, I didn't understand them. And I've just caught on fire with them. I've stitched a couple in the previous years, like in the last 15 years, I've stitched mm-hmm. a couple of reproductions, but just in the last 2 years, I have just really come alive with them. I mean, I really do. And when I found Bristol's, and I don't know what turned me on to Bristol's. Do you remember Gary? I guess it was Nicola, her Harriet Salt is what made me start looking. And then I found your website, and I was like, this is the lady that made those table toppers.
I know.
That's exactly what I thought. When I thought, Claudia Dutcher, that's the lady that made me.
Yeah. What's she doing here?
She knows all about Bristol samplers.
All right. So I have to tell you a story. When I was a shop owner, there was a lady who came in, and she would literally snap her fingers to have me come over and help her.
Okay.
Okay. Now, all right. So that's how that started. And I taught a class for our local EGA group, and I didn't do anything different than I normally did. And my IQ went up 50 points. I kid you not. And so all of a sudden she realized, hey, this person might actually do something or know something. So the Bristol thing is a little like that. I know people don't know. That's why I said people don't know me for this. And it's really fun to watch. I had a little bit at Sassy Jack's where they said, you're the tabletopper person. And I said, yeah. hello. Yeah. It's okay. It's fun, actually. It's a people watching thing. So it's fun.
So the history, though, I mean, that's to me, that's what it is about the samplers is you have really some beautiful cross stitch. And I'll never get over the fact that girls, 10 years, 8 years old created these things. And I don't care how much teacher input there was, they still did them. And, but then the extra layer that doesn't go with any other kind of needlework is that history. Especially then the Bristol samplers. And I mean, that's just a tremendous story. And was it that one sampler? And when you realized what it was, you just started digging and it just never stopped.
Yeah, I just started digging, trying to find out what they were. And then, of course, I needed to own a Redwork one, which they're always, since people know what they are, they're always pricier. And I actually went, I was on my way to another show, and I put a bid on eBay and got to the show in Nashville. And, you know, this is the dial-up modem days when you had to go to get in. And it was like, it's 8 hours since I put my bid, and I put it, the most money I had. And I bought the Emma Sanford sampler. And I'll tell you on the air, I bought it for $175.
Oh, wow.
I kid you not. And my husband was saying, are you sure this is a Bristol? And Augusta had just been released as a chart. And Augusta and Emma look very similar. And I said, yes, this is a Bristol. By that time, I had been looking at every picture I could find and collecting every bit of information. You learn by looking. You learn by seeing. And so, you know, then Emma came into the picture. And then it was all downhill from there. So it was fun.
$175. That's like stealing it.
I know. And I emailed the guy who owned it. And he lived in Gloucester. And I said, do you have any history on this? Because I always ask. Sometimes you're lucky and you get some. And he said, no, we have no relatives by that name. I went, okay, that's all right. So, and the fun thing about the Bristols and the Quaker, a lot of times you can find family history. And the Bristols, of course, they have the orphan records. So if they're signed and dated, a lot of times the trust, the George Mueller Charitable Trust, can give you the child's records, can give you the girl's records. They also have the boys' records too, but for the most part, boys didn't stitch. I've never seen a Bristol sampler done by a boy. But and that makes it fun. And then since I like genealogy stuff, you know, then you can sometimes find what happened to them afterwards, because then you know their parents and you know all that. It's samplers with a story, and the story makes it even more special. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that was the part I could not believe when you were showing at Kim's, showing the pictures of the records.
Mm-hmm.
Because, boy, yeah, once you have the name, oh, all the information you pick up on those girls is incredible.
It makes it personal. It makes you feel like you know them a little bit, or you've heard their story, and it makes it, you just sort of bond with that. I mean, it's wonderful.
Now, do you have you collected several of them, or... Do you let others do that?
Of the records or the samplers?
The samplers.
You know, I collect whatever I can afford.
Yeah. Okay.
You saw most of them. I think you saw all of them at Kim's. I just bought another one since Kim's. So.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh,
so.
You did.
Yeah. I just spent my what Kim paid me. I just spent it. So. Like you get your allowance on Saturday, you go down, it's gone Saturday.
Yep. That's right. I understand that so much, Claudia.
And that's the other part. No. They still seem to be readily available as
there were thousands made.
Yeah.
They just don't, they come up from time to time. So.
Well, I mean, think about it. Like what you said in the class was that was their resume. You know what I mean? So you're going to take care of your resume. I still have my resume. I have no idea. I mean, I have no plans of going into the workforce anytime, but I still have it. So, I mean, you know, I would imagine that was precious to them.
Well, we have the story of the one girl who remember the girl who had her sampler and she picked New Orphan House out.
Yes.
She kept the sampler. But she left her name, but she picked the rest of it out. So she wasn't always, you know, wasn't always being in the orphanage it was a good thing for them, but it was not necessarily what they wanted to tell the world where they'd been.
Right.
Yeah. But still that story, because usually when you think of old world orphanages, you know, you just think of just miserable living conditions and, you know, abuse and, you know, slave labor for all intents and purposes, and the picture you paint and that I've read subsequent, those kids were really taken care of, and it's just really a neat thing.
Yeah, they purposed they prayed, they purposed to take care of the kids, to give them the best they could give, and they really cared. I mean, in Victorian England, they really didn't care about orphans, and the Muller family, and they cared. I mean, and it shows. So.
Mm-hmm.
Have you been there yet?
I've been to the house. So they had a house where the offices were. I haven't been in the buildings, in the original buildings. I've gone by them. Now they have actually opened a new museum in Orphan House 2. I think it's Orphan House 2. They opened it this August. So it's on my bucket list to go back and actually, I'll go in the building and pet the walls, you know. It'd be great. So.
Now, do they have a significant collection of samplers? Or
let me tell you how my association with them happened, and it answers that question. So in 2006, I had gotten Emma, and I had gotten a couple of other pieces, and so we went to England. I closed my shop, my store. We went to England. And our thing was to visit the trust, the office of the trust in Bristol. And they took out a couple samplers. I said, "Do you have more?" And we went to a closet, and there were samplers stacked in cardboard boxes with paper towels in between them.
Oh.
And I looked, and we pulled out, and we photographed, and we looked, and we tried not to drool too much on them. And they had been returned to the orphanage by family members or people who didn't want them. They didn't know what to do with them. So they came back to the orphanage because they knew they were connected. And I said, "Has anybody ever volunteered to do a catalog for you?" And they said, "No." And I went, "Okay." So I came home, and I thought, how can I – California girl here at that point, do something for the Bristol, the Muller Foundation in England. And so that's how all that came to be. So I worked with Alan Jessup, and I put together a catalog for them. I used their pictures of what they sent me, but I also asked permission from everybody I knew who had a Bristol sampler behind the scenes. Could I use your picture? Would you let me use this? And so I was able to put together a catalog of the chronology of the samplers that had existed, not all of them, but, samples of what we could selections from the different years from 1840 on. And so I did that for them. So that's how I sort of got to know them, and they got to know me, and, behind the scenes, we all shared information. It was great.
Wow.
So there's literally stacks of them.
Yeah. And they bring them out from time to time. They brought them out. Last time I was there, I went with a group from Susan Greening Davis, and they brought them out. And I think I talked more than the docent there who was talking about him. So I sometimes get going and you can't shut me up, but they know me.
Now, in terms of reproduction, are they fairly flexible with that, or do they not like to do that?
No, they actually don't consider them their pieces. They consider them, a gift. And so Doreen I'm going to get it wrong. Doreen from the UK, I'm not going to quote her company. Sabine from Germany. Has reproduced some of them. I just did M.H. Smith, which is in the collection. And, so they don't mind. Yeah, I just try and always give them a donation. I mean, I try and give back to them because they can, now they have old folks' homes in the UK. So I figure we're all headed there soon. So that's okay.
Please tell me that they're stored better than cardboard boxes with paper towel.
I think it's better now. Good. I haven't seen them in the closet again. I've just seen them out on the table. And I don't know what they did since they moved them to the new offices. But if I ever get back there, I'll let you know. So.
Yeah, because that makes me cringe.
Yeah.
When you reproduce, when you reproduced MH, mm-hmm. Is that off a picture, or do they send you the sampler, or how does that work? No.
I did it from a picture.
Well, I was going to say.
When Alan was there with them, he was a photographer, and so he could take really good detailed pictures, and so I was able to work for him. Yeah.
And I assume these are all in good shape, or is it a real mixed bag?
It's sort of hit and miss. Most of them are pretty good. I mean, they look, they, a couple of them have some holes, and, you know, it just depends on what their life was before they came back to the orphanage, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And multicolored ones, are there more of those, or are those still pretty?
They're still pretty rare. For the Mueller collection, there's probably, I don't want to guess. I'm thinking there's less than 10 of those.
Oh.
There might be less than 5. And it's fun to see them, because what they've done with those is they've worked them like on napkins and different types of fabric. So, you know, like a napkin would be something that had a printed border around the outside edge. And then you can see the girl has stitched in between that border. Mm-hmm. It's fun. Yeah. So the red ones are still the most common. They're the ones that everybody had to do a red one. Not everybody got to do a multicolor one. We think that the multicolor ones were given, the girls who were the better stitchers, who actually liked stitching and who wanted to make the time to do it, the older girls were given or could request the opportunity to do a multicolor piece.
Mm.
Yeah.
When you look through all of those, at some point, do they all start to look the same, or is there still a uniqueness across the board?
I think there. Well, you know, you're looking at the one who still has. You're asking the one who still has stars in her eyes over there. I think they all share similar things, but they're all unique. Mm-hmm. And they're unique in their placement. They're unique in their mistakes. They're unique in how well they stitched them.
Mm-hmm.
What colors they used, if they were multicolored ones. I love them. Every time I see one, I mean, I love it.
Yeah, I have to agree with you on that, because I've looked at what's online. I've looked at it over and over and over for like the last 6 months, and I would have to agree with you. You can tell just looking at the pictures, you can tell. Yeah, they're all similar, but they're not all the same. No. Yeah. And what they chose, you know, what motifs they chose to use in their sampler, and how they chose to arrange those motifs in their sampler, it's always different.
Yeah, so. And they make it their own. I mean, there are girls, I'm sure, and I think Emma Sanford was one of them, that really didn't like to stitch. And they had to get through it, and they had to get it done. So if you don't like to do it, and your roommate or your bedmate or whatever has a sampler you like, follow that format. You know, that's that's actually okay. But you know, you could put as much or as little in, and you know, they it was really their resume with the needle, so it was good for them to do the best they could.
Mm-hmm. And I like the ones where they have the initials in there. And you told us during the class that was like their bunk mates or their friends.
Yeah, could be family, could be friends, could be, and the if you have a numerical, like three numbers at a time, that's usually their bed numbers.
Oh, I see.
So, you don't know if you can find the history of the sampler and see that, you know, they had a brother who was named Ernest or whatever, and their last name was started with an H, and there's an EH in there, then you might be able to track down who that was. So.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's what, for me, one of the fun things about looking at not just Bristol samplers, but samplers in general, is looking for the kid.
Yeah.
You know, I hate this, or, oh, this didn't quite come out even. I'll just cram it in here in the corner. It'll be fine, and just end this. And I love those little insights that you get where the kid, I really want to go play, and I'm really tired of doing this. And, yeah.
Yeah, I have one sampler where the girl pricked her finger. I don't know if she did it on purpose. It's not a Bristol piece, and she smeared blood all over it, maybe hoping she could get out of finishing it. And she had to finish it, and she was not a good stitcher. She was I'm sure she didn't have fun doing that one at all.
Yeah, see, that's the part there. I'll even shed blood to get out of this. Yep.
Never works.
Yep. No. Are there other types of needlework that came out of the Bristol orphanages, or are they just all samplers?
Perforated paper. They actually, going back again, perforated paper when they were, when the girls
now,
were
Claudia, learning, do you like perforated paper?
you think? They actually did needle books, and they did like little pin cushions. Like you'd make a little four-sided thing from the paper and put a top on it, make a pin cushion out of it. They did that to raise money. So the girls, when they were learning to stitch, some of the younger girls would make up some of those pieces and they would sell them and it would raise money. So I've seen those, and they did the hem stitching. They had a whole curriculum. They also did, the older girls, they did nightgown cases. They've done pillow covers. They've done some other things. And so it's not just samplers, but I believe every girl had to do a sampler. And then if they liked it, they could actually do something else. So.
Yeah. Well, that's good to know. Cause I've wondered that if it just was, this is the curriculum, do it, move on. Or if, they actually went beyond that, you know.
The ones that wanted to and could make time, the older girls were involved running the orphanage. So their time was pretty much taken up. By the time they were 15, 16, they were doing household duties. They were doing some of the other stuff. So you had to make time. You know, if you were going to do something else, it had to be, you had to purpose to do it. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You got busier as you got older. It happens to all of us. Yeah.
I think that's still happening.
have you seen any of the needles or the thread unstitched? Do they have any of those?
I haven't seen any. Well, I'm going to take it back. There's some, yes, but not in person. I've seen it in pictures.
Because the thread, I mean, that much red thread, they must have bought it by the truckload.
Yeah. It was cheap, and it was, you could see it. You could see your mistakes. And red was a very common thread for English school samplers. So, yeah.
Yeah. What a fun story. It's not fun. I mean, that's just truly one of the great human stories,
yeah.
I think, really of our time. Yeah. There aren't too many like that.
Mm-mm.
And especially for a guy who was less than ideal citizen when he started out.
Yeah, well, that's why he took his hands off the money, because he said, you know what, I'm going to let God provide it, and I'm going to step back because we're going to give somebody else the credit here, and I don't need it. So it's good.
And that you bring that up. Yeah, everything, all those buildings they built, everything, they had the money before they started, and they, it was all just showed up. That's so cool.
Yeah. No thermometer in the back of the church.
Yeah.
No building program. Yeah.
That's a real testament right there.
Yep.
Yep. What are you doing for your own stitching these days?
Not too much.
Okay.
I'm doing, I have fun making up those, what I call the projects that sort of go with the other stuff. So I have a fun time trying to see if I can recreate some antique pieces or if I can do some different things. So right now I'm not doing a whole lot of personal stitching. I just don't have a lot of time. But I like everything I do anyway. So,
Yeah. Well, it's just,
yeah.
Just interesting. And the other part is your husband. from what I read, none of this happens without his support. And
yeah, he's great. He's he now knows. I've got the Bristles hung up in this house, and we used to have them in a bag, and I take them out and do talks about them and put them back, and he now, we always knew if the house burned down, we grab a couple of bags. One bag had the Quaker pieces in it, and the other bag had the Bristol pieces in it. Now they're all hung up. So I said, what do we do? I said, we just grab the wall. It's okay. No, he's good. He's you met him at Sassy Jack's, or you saw him at Sassy Jack's.
Yeah.
He's actually very good. He likes it. It's not his thing, but he likes that I'm happy with it. So,
and that to me is, that's the way my husband is. He doesn't give two, cents about what I'm doing or what I'm stitching or anything like that. But he'll sit and he'll listen to me, talk about it endlessly. And I do. And he gets to hear it about it. And your husband, just struck me in that way too. And was an integral part in your lecture with the computer and all that. And that's just what a testimony to your relationship and to, the sacrifice and give and take of marriage. And he was a Yeah, he was very quiet behind the scenes guy, but he was certainly there.
Yeah, no, we've done music together. We've done this together. I tell him, you know, he has to travel with me to shows because he's a driver and he's worth two pieces of luggage. So that's 100 pounds of luggage. So, you know, he's got to come. And, you know, it's fun and we get to go see different things. And, you know, and he's a computer person. So he's very technically capable. So if there's something that does go sideways somewhere, he can usually help fix it. So,
yeah.
Well, and that's right. The music part. Now, you guys both still sing?
Yeah, we do. We both still sing. So,
and you play piano still?
I play piano. Yeah. Not as much these days, but I do play piano. I have a friend that has a Steinway piano, and I get to visit him once a week. And now he's decided I need to play his piano once in a while. And you know, he doesn't have to really twist my arm to do that. So. Of course, then I want a Steinway piano. I should just stick to the samplers because they're actually cheaper.
Yeah. I think that's another level of cost. Yes.
Yeah. No. We're not making that much money. So.
Yes. No. Singing in the church or what are you doing? Because there were several different groups that you guys were involved in.
Yeah. I met Bruce when I was the choir director. He was the choir director and I was his accompanist. And he said, "You'll never be able to play this." And I said, "Yes, I will." And so that's sort of how it started. And the piece was accompaniment was by Mozart. And so I've known Bruce for a long time. I knew him for a long time before we got married. When he asked me to marry him, I almost told him no, because I knew if I married him, he wouldn't go home. So he would have to be here all the time. So anyway, we've been married, I think, for 26 years, and we're doing good. And we've it flipped a little bit later. I was a work church. We had a traditional service in a big church. We had a small traditional service in a 1,000-plus member church, and I was the worship leader and the pianist, and I sang alto in the quartet for that. And so I became Bruce's boss sort of for 7 years. And then we moved to Arizona, and he's singing in the barbershop group, and we both sing in Saddlebrook Singers. And we actually did a duet together last year for the Christmas concert, and people are going, "You guys can sing together." And it's like, yeah, we've done that. So we're still doing it. Music is something that lights him up. It lights me up. It's always been part of our lives, and we're privileged to be able to still do it. So,
yeah. Well, I think, music is great. It's important part of what Marga and I do. And it's,
it's fun. I mean, you know, if you're a musician, it's a fun thing, and it's great to have the opportunity, and hopefully you still sound good enough that people aren't throwing stuff at you yet.
So. Well, you're pretty safe in a church, that's for sure, but otherwise.
Not necessarily.
I was going to say, I've made some squeakers before, and it's not been pretty. All the ladies trying to look at me like, "What's wrong with you?"
Well, church music is really the worship team concept in a church. This is a whole nother rabbit trail, but mostly you have young people leading it. You have younger people leading it. So when we did the service with more traditional hymns, the four of us who did the quartet were older. And so we knew we had to be the best. We had to, because otherwise they're going to go, "Oh, it's old people." So God provided for that. We worked hard at it. It was good. It was a great mix of people. And, you know, it was fun. It's fun to do.
Yeah. Yeah. Church music. It's, I've always enjoyed it. I know, Vanna, you are.
Yeah, I'm regular. Soprano. Yeah. I'm soprano.
Hey, next time we get together, we'll sing it. We can sing a trio.
Oh, no, I don't sing. No, good. No.
No, I wasn't including you. I was going to put
Oh, okay. Good. Good.
Gary does handbells. That's what he and Marga does. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a labor of love, and it's fun.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I love it. Yeah.
And he does a beautiful job. He's actually, you know, the conductor. He conducts them.
Ah, nice. Okay.
Yeah. I enjoy it. I enjoy it. And I've got a good group of people who there's some talent there. So we're able to.
That makes it easier.
Yeah. We're able to do some challenging pieces and pull them off. And that's so much fun. We had a new pastor. Well, now he's not new anymore. He's been around for a while. First time he heard us. He says, you can do that with handbells. Yeah, you can.
Yeah.
It's just not chords and quarter notes. Yep.
Yeah. Oh, and it's not fun, though.
Yeah. You can make them dance. Yep.
Yep. That's good. Yep.
Well, Claudia, we knew it would be a lot of fun. Thanks for doing this with us.
You're welcome. Thanks.
Yeah.
For
thank you, Claudia. Yeah. It's, you're just really are one of my favorite people. And I mean that genuinely. And just meeting you was a pleasure. And this hour has flown by and we have to have you back again.
Well, we have a few other things to talk about. So
that's true.
You know, if it fits in your schedule and I can be useful to you, let me know.
It'll fit.
All right. Yeah.
All right.
It'll fit. All right. Okay. Thanks, Claudia. Thanks to everybody for listening.